evening, everyone. I am Rosetta, and I am an alcoholic. My daughter is here this evening. This is the first time I've had a family member present while I've shared my story, and I don't think that'll make any difference other than my voice might quiver just a little bit more at times than it normally would. So, you know, I was told that I need to share in a general way what it's like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'd like to tell you that my sobriety date is March 26, 1988. So by the grace of God, three more days, I'll be celebrating 26 years, 26 blessed years. I just can't tell you what recovery has and getting God in my life has done. And I actually have two home groups. There's a very small 7:30 a.m. group that meets at the club in Harrisonburg on Wednesday mornings, and it's Asbill Seasoned Literature Group. And then on Sunday mornings, 11 o'clock, we have a meeting at Massanutta Springs. So anytime you're in the area on Sundays or a very early 7:30 Wednesday mornings, please feel free to join us. We'd love to have you. And I know Sam shared in his email that the group's message is recovery through sponsorship, home group, steps, and service. And yeah, I could just say, yeah, I'll just go ahead and say that. It is. That's exactly, you know, that's exactly how this program works. So I grew up across the mountain, a little town called Timberville, and I'll just get on with this thing. And anyway, I was I was a chicken farmer's daughter and really felt the stigma of that. I mean, like, it wasn't anything to be proud of, I can assure you. And so even as a very small child, I felt real inferior, that I didn't fit in. And even to the point of being the one green-eyed, fair-haired, right-handed child in a left-handed, brown-eyed, you know, brown-haired family, and truly that's the way it was. I was blonde, green-eyed, right-handed, and all the rest of them were brown-eyed, brown, and I thought, well, that automatically makes me different. It either makes me very special or it makes me lower than whale snot, to where there was something wrong with me that I had to be adopted. And this is the sick kind of thinking that went on long before I ever picked up the first drink. You know, it was that not fitting in. And the first feelings I remember were feelings of fear. I had a very, very dominating father, and, you know, he ruled with an iron fist. And I don't remember a lot of the physical abuse to me personally, but I guess even way back then, my mind would play tricks and do things that would keep me safe, because my mother told me one time that, and I don't really know how old I was, probably 10, 11, somewhere in there, but I said I couldn't remember my father ever beating me. And she said, "You don't remember the time that your dad caught you and Gloria talking to some guys and said, he hit you," and she said, "you were so traumatized that I wouldn't even come out to eat the evening meal." And so I don't recall any of that whatsoever. So I guess my mind had a way of keeping my own safe little world. You know, my father couldn't do that to me. He couldn't be that kind of person. So anyway, those are the really early feelings that I can recall. And really prior to grade school, that's about all I can tell you. I can remember looking at pictures and seeing a cute little blonde-haired girl sitting there missing her two front teeth and so on, looking fairly happy. But I can't remember, you know, truly being happy or truly having a safe place to go as a child. So as, you know, we go on into school, just always feeling very average, like I had to work extra hard to get anything accomplished, and and I wanted to be liked by other kids in school, but I just felt like I didn't fit in. There was something wrong with me that I didn't fit in. So I don't remember anything significant then up until I started high school. And as I got into high school, I remember that my father had to be sent away. I didn't know where he was sent away to until some years later for drinking and getting into all kinds of trouble. And so I do believe that my father was an alcoholic. I think the only thing that happened was that he stopped drinking. And I feel so sad that, he never, well, there may have been an opportunity, I don't know, but that he never was blessed with the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that he truly had a God of his understanding in his life. That just makes me real sad sometimes when I think that, he had to go through his life just being miserable, being very mean, angry, and taking it out on everyone else because that's what we do. If I don't have something to cover up that hurt and that anger and everything, I'm going to lash out at other people. And I did my share of that. And there's been times I saw my father in me, and I didn't like me very much at all. And, and yet I used those things as a means for, well, if you had to be brought up the way I was and you had the father that I had and you had to go through the things that we did, you would drink too. There was always some excuse. But, going into early high school, of course, I'm like most red-blooded American girls, guys are there and they're looking real good, They're looking real good. But I also hear people talking about drinking And around my house, even though I believe with all my heart that my father was an alcoholic, I can only tell you what I believe. I can't say that he was. There was absolutely no drinking. It was a teetotaler house, and you better not be caught with anything there. So, my earliest thoughts were, how can I sneak a drink into this house? I'm also a very rebellious child, in that sense that a lot of times I didn't consciously think, well, I just want to make the old man mad and do something that's going to, because I was a little bit of afraid of that because I knew, like I said, when I said he ruled with an iron fist, I truly do mean the fist and anything else that he could get his hands on. So, but I wanted to do the things that other people did that seemed to make them have a good time. And a lot of that was talking about drinking. I mean, they talked about how they went out and partied and had a good time. And, so I want to do these things too. And so let's see. My first experience with drinking was, I liked this girl, but I also liked her because I knew and had heard that her mother did homebrew. And I thought, if I can talk my parents into letting me go home with her, I can get to experience this thing called alcohol and, see what all the hype is about, I guess, so to speak. And so I had to beg and beg and beg for my mother and father to finally allow me to go home with this girl. And so all I can remember, it was just always about me. I mean, I'd like to think that I wasn't such a selfish person, but man, I mean, practically everything I did, it was about me. It's like, when are these people ever going to bed so that we could sneak down in the basement? Because this was the plan. I mean, we had this all planned out. We were going to sneak down there, get some of this homebrew and taste it. And I said, oh, my goodness, this is the nastiest stuff in the world. how can people talk about enjoying themselves and, when alcohol tastes like this? But I will tell you, it didn't stop me. It did not stop me from continuing to drink until I felt that release. And when I felt that, I think I truly had my first spiritual experience. It was in a bottle. And I don't like to think of that today, but it was like it gave me freedom of fear. This little shorter than I am now, I think, kind of fat girl with ponytails and stuff that, you know, I was like, all of a sudden she became a lot taller, a lot thinner, and I could dance. I mean, I could do stuff that, you know, alcohol was my miracle cure. I mean, it finally made me feel a part of, and I didn't want to lose that. But the thing that I lost the very first time I drank was how to gauge. You know, I always overshot my mark from the very first time in that basement, drinking that homebrew, thinking it tasted awful. I was not about to surrender and let you think I was a wimp. So, you know, I went down with the porcelain throne, and I hugged it pretty good that night, and went to school the next day not feeling too good at all. So that was my first experience. And, you know, and I think a normal person that has that kind of experience with alcohol and thinks that it really tastes like crud and all that stuff would... I don't think they obsess about when they're going to get it the next time. You know, but I did. When am I going to be able to, you know, get out of the house or do something with a girlfriend? You know, because we weren't allowed to date. And at 16, so this was, I don't know what, I guess it was about 14, 15 years old when that took place. So at 15, we were allowed to double date. So my sister and I, what do? We jump into cars. As soon as we get out the end of the road, we jump into our boyfriend's cars and we go our separate ways. I'm sure I'm not the only one that's ever done those kinds of things. But, you know, this is just what we do. And then we meet up at 10 o'clock, 10:30, whenever curfew was, and, you know, jump back in and go racing back at dirt road, leaving a trail of smoke a mile high to make sure we'd be home on time. And I remember he was to be my first husband, but, you know, it was really cool to have a car. I mean, you know, a guy that had a nice car, and, you know, he'd buy the liquor and he'd take a slug and right out of the bottle, and it's like, well, if you can do it, I can too. Oh, Jesus, that was some tough stuff. So I didn't mind mixing mine after that. I really did not have to be one of the guys in that sense. And went on, and I married this gentleman, and had three beautiful daughters, and two of them are the same age. So I have twin daughters that are 44, and this gorgeous young lady sitting up here. And I won't tell you her age because, you know, that's none of y'all's business. I don't know how I got old enough to have somebody. So, you know, I just don't understand how that stuff happens. But truly, truly was blessed with three beautiful daughters. And I wanted to be a good mom. I truly wanted to be a good mom. All these things in my head and the things, I mean, the beaver cleaver type things in the household, and, you know, I just wanted to be them. I had no clue how to be. I certainly didn't have good role models. I mean, I know my mom, you know, loved us and stuff, but she didn't have much to go on. And you know, eventually, I return to the thing that makes me feel better. It's alcohol. It takes me outside of all those fears of not being a good daughter, not being a good wife, not being a good mother. I don't know how to be any of these things. And so I truly believe that there was something missing inside of me as a, you know, from birth on. I you know, other people may think that it's things that happen in their life, and you know, I truly think there was just something missing, because I've heard of other people that had a horrible, horrible, much worse childhood than mine. And they seemed to be okay, and they went on with life. But I always turned to alcohol to make me fit in and to be okay. So, let's see. Well, needless to say, I'm out of school now. I did graduate high school. My first husband went to Vietnam, and when he got back, we set up housekeeping and had my daughter Lynette, and then I got pregnant with the twins. And as I said, I wanted to be a good mom, but as time went on, I just kept feeling that itch, like, you know, something's missing. It had to be. If I just waited a while longer before I got married, I'd have been okay, you know, because I just wasn't married to the right man. Or if I hadn't had kids so young, you know, always looking for some excuse why drinking was going to be okay. And so one of the hardest parts of my story, and I don't think I've gotten through it one time yet without crying, and I know I won't tonight, not with my daughter sitting here. But one of the hardest things that I've ever done is to walk away from my children. And I think she was 9 or 10, and her sisters were 8 or 9. So they're right in that age. And, you know, and I had to leave because my disease was beckoning me to a point that, you know, I had to get out of that house. I just had to go. And, you know, and I made up excuses like, well, their father makes more money than I do. He can take better care of them. And the truth is, again, it was all about me. It was my disease calling me, even with three little girls standing there saying, Mommy, please don't go. This disease takes you lots of places you never wanted to go. And so I'm hoping that's it for the, like, weepy part of my story. we'll get out of that. But I did. And, you know, but as I left, you know, I had complete freedom now. I didn't have three little girls that I had to be home and take care of. I could go out to the clubs. I was living in Charlottesville at the time, and you know, there was lots of discos, and, you know, of course, you know, I wanted to be, you know, Donna Summer's disco lady, swing me up in the air and do all this stuff, go out to the clubs, and just always looking for something that's going to make me feel okay and feel like I fit in again. And I can tell you, I never found that drink after a certain point that ever allowed me to do that. I got drunk a lot of times. Blacked out a lot of times, did a lot of things when I was drinking, and my story will probably be more of a general way tonight than normally. You know, I did things that most of us did. I used men, I used new clothes, I used cars, I used anything material to try to make me feel better. And you know, what I found out after I sobered up, I was stuffing all that stuff in my God hole, and there wasn't a thing in there that was going to fit except God. And but I spent a lot of years researching. I can assure you, I was out there. I was going to try my darndest to see if I couldn't find something that was going to fit in there and make it okay. Because I always, too, thought that the alcoholic was the drunk that we would see, you know, really dirty, ragged clothes, wine bottles sticking out of the paper bag. I mean, truly, in my mind, I thought that's what the alcoholic was. And, you know, so this kind of insanity goes on, and then I take on victim number two, husband number two, and I don't know. Maybe truthfully in that marriage, maybe I was the victim. in marriage number two, maybe I was the victim. This guy had beaten me and done just lots of really mean things prior to ever marrying him. But we drank a lot alike. You know, he liked to drink, and, man, I liked to drink. So we drank a lot alike, but But he liked to get mean a lot, too. And so over that 6.5-year marriage, you know, I ended up in the hospital a couple of times, broken jaw, different things, you know, always using the excuse that, you know, but you don't understand. And this is from my kids that were saying, Mom, don't you think you drink too much? Mom, why don't you leave him? Mom, why do you let him do this to you? And, you know, so my self-esteem and the guilt and shame and remorse was just taking me deeper and deeper to a point that, I mean, I just didn't know what else to do. I felt stuck. And truthfully, at that point in my life, I felt like this is what I deserve. For all the bad things that I've done in my life, this is what I deserve, and this is where God intends me to stay. And, I mean, that's a horrible place to feel stuck. I was just, like, so hopeless. Didn't know, at the time, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, we have a God that is so great that he truly works in mysterious ways. You know, this husband I was married to worked at UVA, and at that time it was the treatment center. You know, in every corner there was a treatment center. And so UVA would send home little pamphlets and stuff and said that if you have a family member with a drug or alcohol problem, please call this number. You know, we may be able to help. And I didn't know what that meant. But I was pretty sure at that point in my life that I had a problem because my drinking was getting worse and worse. And every time I try to stop, and some evenings, I didn't know what withdrawal was or any of that kind of stuff. I didn't know what was going on with my body at the time. But every time I try to stop, I would just like pace the floor. I would be thinking, well, maybe just one. Maybe just one. And well, actually, there was a lot of times I thought maybe just one. It never ended up being just one. And but again, I didn't know what was going on with me. So when he would bring those pamphlets home, and he just tossed them on the counter there in the kitchen, and you know, and I'd read them, and I took them in and stuck them in one of my bureau drawers. And to me, that was God prepping me. You know, and it's like, again, I have no clue what's going on, but I just know I'm hating my life more and more every day. So, anyway, I don't know exactly what went on that weekend, because towards the end of my drinking, I might go into a blackout with two drinks. I might have four or five drinks. But blackouts were starting to frequent my drinking a lot. And so I really didn't know what happened a lot of times. But when I was told that I'd gone through a whole evening one time and that I actually was engaging in conversation and everything else and that I don't remember a single bit of it, panic. I mean, panic just set in. It's like, I never knew people could do that. I always called people liars that said they were in blackouts or that they did things when they were drinking and couldn't remember them. And here I am experiencing those things now. I've gotten to a point in my drinking where I don't know what's going to happen. So it's about this time, too, that I'm starting to isolate a lot because I never know what's going to happen once I walk out the door. And, I didn't know I had such a history. Wow. So, but anyway, these pamphlets are in there. When my husband would get mad at me, one of his ways of keeping his wife under control was to take her on wild car rides on country roads at about 90 miles an hour. And I really truly believed that I was not going to make it home alive that day. I truly feared for my life. And the reason that, you know, he wanted to show me who was boss is I'd finally told him that I wanted out of that marriage. And he said there was no way in hell that he'd kill me first. And I believed him. I really did believe him. And so this was like on a Friday evening or something. So Saturday, you know, my usual thing, I'm sitting there drinking, praying that I have enough to get me just drunk enough that I can pass out one more time. Let's see. I used to think that I was a sound sleeper. My daughter Robin did not get her driver's license when she was in high school. So at this point in time, she was living with me, and so she would call me like 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I always went to bed early because I had to get up and be at the restaurant. I opened the restaurant for the breakfast shift, and sometimes, literally, my head would be here, the phone here, and the phone would ring, she said, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 times before I'd come out of my stupor and answer the phone. Well, when you're that drunk, you don't just jump up and, you know, be able to see clearly or anything. There's many times I should have been thrown under the jail for the way I drove, endangering my children's lives, other people's lives. There were times when I can remember going to pick her up where I would hang my head out the window just praying to God that one of those lines would come over to meet the other one. I would close one eye. I'd do anything and could not make the lines come together. And it was truly, you know, only by the grace of God that I didn't kill someone during that time. And never really got a DUI. Should I have had them? Many of them. Many times. I can even remember one time during this marriage that cops stopped us one night. My husband was driving, and we got a trailer, a camper behind us. And he said, sir, he said, you drink? And he said, yeah, I've had a couple drinks. He said, well, I think you've had a few too many. He said, you better get your wife to drive this thing out of here. You're going to have to park it. Well, I looked at him, and I almost blurted out in front of the cop, well, I'm too drunk to drive. And it was like, I knew that I was, but, you know, for some reason, it was a lot different 20-some years ago than it is now. And anyway, after that wild ride that night, I was sitting in the living room, like I did a lot of times, nursing the last couple of drinks, hoping that I could get to sleep. And I thought if I drank beer, I wouldn't become an alcoholic, that I couldn't be an alcoholic. So, and especially if you drank beer in pretty bottles, like I always thought Michelob Light, you know, had that nice pretty little bottle and the neck on it, and people made candles out of them, you know, candle holders and stuff. So that tells you how sick I am. So I'm sitting there, and I can remember the thought, I'm going to die if I keep on drinking. And I'm so afraid I'm going to die if I don't drink. I mean, it was truly that moment of clarity that they talk about in our literature. Now, I didn't know that's what was happening at that moment because, again, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous or anything like that. But I went in that bedroom, and I dug in that bureau drawer, and I pulled those papers out, and I called the treatment center. And it was part of UVA at the time. And told them that I thought I had a drinking problem. And I'm sure she talked to me for, you know, a few minutes, and she said, this was a Saturday night. She said, well, do you think that you can make it until Tuesday? She said, that's when our intake counselors will be in. And I just flippantly, oh, yeah, no problem. You know, I'm calling, telling her I got a drinking problem, and yet this other part of me wants to deny that I have a drinking problem. Oh, yeah, no problem. I'll be okay. So I'm so afraid, and I have gone back on my word so many times. I mean, I didn't show up for functions for my children in school because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to. So I thought, well, I can't just say, you know, to them. But, I mean, I did call my daughter Robin because she was working that night. And she's the one that I went to pick up so many times drunk. And I said, honey, I think Mom's got a drinking problem. And she probably thought, well, I could have told you that a long time ago. But, again, I had gone back on my word so many times with my children that, you know, why would I think they're even going to, like, believe me that I'm going to do something about this? So I called a friend that I worked with, and I thought, you know, I think to myself, if I tell enough people, I won't go back on my word because then it's going to be too much shame and all involved. But it took what it took. And these are the things I did to ensure that I would walk into that treatment center that evening. And what does that lady do but ask me to fill out paperwork for a 28-day inpatient program? And I can just remember, I'm just like backing up with my hands up. I can't do that. I cannot do that. I have too many commitments. I mean, there's too many bills to be paid, blah, blah, blah. You know, thank God they're trained. That they are trained to look out for us idiots when we can't look out for ourselves. I mean, you know, she knew the denial that was, you know, creeping in there. And she said, please don't leave. She said, our outpatient counselors will be finishing up in just a short amount of time. And she said, would you please wait and talk to one of them? Maybe you will qualify for outpatient, you know. It's like, I mean, you know, I can look back now and laugh about some of that stuff. But at the time, it was like, oh, so I'm not quite as bad if I can do out. I mean, this is how crazy I am. I think I'm not as bad if I'm going to do outpatient. So anyway, I did. I talked to the counselors, and we got me set up, and I signed all these forms and agreed to go to these meetings that I didn't know anything about. I mean, I was in such a, I mean, I was so fearful and all that. I mean, I didn't know what was expected of me. When I called and asked for help, I thought they were going to teach me how to drink like a lady, which I'd never done all my life, so I don't know why I thought they were going to be able to do it. I mean, I just didn't know what to expect. So, anyway, I started going to these outpatient treatment meetings, and the first three steps of our program are up on the wall in the room that we meet in. Again, I still don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But one of those little forms that I signed said that I would attend X amount of meetings during the time that I was attending, you know, the program there. So after a couple of weeks, the counselor says, so how many meetings, you know, he's going around the room asking, and he gets to me. And, of course, again, you know, one more strike against me. Everybody else has gone to two or three meetings, and Rosetta said, none. You know, and I could just feel myself cowering. And he said, well, why not? And I said, I didn't know I was supposed to. And then, you know, just very, very kindly showed me the form that I'd signed. And he said, these will help you. You will hear your story. And I wasn't about to ask questions because, heaven forbid, you would think I was dumb, you know, and didn't understand what you were talking about. How am I going to hear my story when I haven't even opened my mouth yet, you know? And he said, you really don't even have to, you know, introduce yourself. He said, you can just, you know, or, you know, read or whatever. He said, you know, you can always just pass. You don't have to share. And I thought, well, what kind of meetings are these? So the first meeting I decided to go to was, again, in Charlottesville, and it was the young people's meeting on a Saturday morning. You know, I'm 38 at the time, and I certainly didn't consider myself a young person. I consider 38 pretty young right now. But I told him, when he was suggesting this meeting, I said, but I'm not a young person, you know, at 38, you know, I'm not a young person. And he said, it's okay. it's okay. He said, you don't, he said, it's just considered that, but in heart, not in age, not in numbers. So I agreed to go and was going to meet one of the girls that was in treatment there with me. And as God would have it, you know, every now and then we have to stand on our own 2 feet. And he wants us to do the footwork ourselves. Her car broke down and she couldn't be there that morning. I guess there was a couple of nice things about that husband I was married to at the time. At least he had the decency to come by and tell me that she wasn't going to make it. This was kind of pre-cell phone era, too. they weren't out there at the time. So I thought, I cannot walk into that room by myself. And I had my hand on the car door, and there was something just said, if you walk away, you'll never come back. You'll never make it, Rosetta. You'll never go to another meeting. And so I walked in that room absolutely petrified. One girl, one person in that room I knew. And the chairs were in this huge circle. It was a great big room. So it was a big circle and then one on the backside. And she was sitting back over in that far corner. And, man, I hightailed it to her and sat beside her. Never saw her again. Never. Outside of the meeting or, you know, in the meeting. But I do believe that God put her there for me so that I would have a familiar face to sit beside during that meeting. I picked up, you know, a white chip and my surrender chip. Not really, again, even understanding because, you know, everybody's, come on, get up. You want to try that? I guess I do. you know, whatever you tell me, I'm like that little chameleon. I'll do what you want me to do. I become what you want me to become. I like to think that I'm not that way today. But, you know, sometimes I needed to become something other than who I was and what I was. And so that was the beginning journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never did ask that counselor what he meant by I was going to hear my story. And I certainly didn't expect some man to tell my story. But when that guy got up there, you know, about a month or so into the program, and he started talking about those feelings of inadequacy and not fitting in and all this stuff, it was like, oh, my goodness. Now I know what that man was talking about. I didn't have to open my mouth. And I heard someone talking about what was going on inside of me. So, I certainly haven't done a lot of things the way that it's been suggested. Like, it took me several months to ask someone to be my sponsor because, again, I would hear people talking about their sponsor, and it's like, what is this thing they call a sponsor, for goodness sake, you know? I mean, I understand, you know, car race sponsors and things like that, but, you know, who in the world is going to sponsor me, you know, and how do I do this thing? So they talked about, you know, the little literature racks. And one day I was standing there and I saw this thing, sponsorship. And I said, oh, my God. And they told me that the literature was free. So when nobody was looking, I snatched that one up to read. And I thought, well, I had better get me one of these sponsors. So I asked a gal that had been around a while and who had been very kind to me to be my sponsor, and that was when I started doing the steps. And I think I did one, you know. I don't think there was any problem in knowing that I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. I mean, my life was totally unmanageable. And I felt pretty insane, so you know, but it was almost like I just remember, like, it's time to do step 4. But it's like, I don't want to do that. you know, like I said, you know, I would take suggestions, but in my time and not understanding completely. So was my first sponsor, like, probably the best sponsor? No. But she... When I was about 6 months sober, I was cutting the grass and trimming the grass along the edge of the house, pulling the mower. I tripped, fell, pulled the mower up on my foot. They had to amputate 3 toes on my right foot. So needless to say, I wasn't driving for a while. She came and got me. She did kind things that made me feel a part of. So whether she was the greatest step sponsor or not, she did things that made me feel a part of. And so I'm extremely grateful for her. And, talking about service, I mean, it was probably at about, I had to have time to heal up from the surgery and get back to work and everything. So I would say between 8 and 9 months sober. My home group at the time was St. John's in right across from was the Rotunda? Yeah, there at UVA. And they said, my sponsor told me, she said, you need to get a key to the cabinet and you need to show up at such and such a time. And she said, and the chairs go just like you see them here now. And she said, so you need to show up at X, this time. And oh, wow. I am really moving up in this society. I mean, it was like amazing. You trust me with a key to the coffee cabinet, and I get to set these chairs up, and I might even just set them up nicer than the next person does. Again, it's all about Rosetta. Heaven forbid that I could just be one of. But it was little things like that, and back then a lot of meetings, even in churches, were smoking meetings, and so simple things like doing the ashtrays, putting chairs up, sweeping the floors, whatever got me away from thinking about drinking and getting back to those meetings. And whether it was because I had to set the chairs up better than the person before me or the person that might come after me, I don't care what it was. It got me here, and at that point, I could hear the things that I needed to hear to help me stay sober. I love that, that this is the third month, and, in our literature, in our little book is mostly about the third step and turning our lives and our will over to the care of God and things like that. And I'm sure I've just forgotten half of the stuff I was going to tell you all about that was going to be so great. see, they always say there's several stories, like the one you want to tell, the one you did tell, and the one you wished you'd told or something. I don't know. See, I didn't even say that right, but you all know what I'm talking about. I just know that, before I got up here, I asked God to put the words in my mouth and that I would hope that I could, help at least one other alcoholic to not want to take a drink today. But one of the things that has been paramount in my sobriety is a sponsor. I cannot even imagine. I know I couldn't have stayed sober. If I hadn't had someone that I could go to on a regular basis to talk about things that I can't throw out on the floor at meetings and to give me suggestions on how to work through them and all, there's no way. No way I could stay sober. And, my sponsor has a sponsor, and her sponsor is currently 91 years old and 49 years sober, which isn't. 48? Yeah, because my husband has, her husband has a sponsor, and they're both sober the same amount of time. So, not my sponsor, but the 91-year-old's husband. And I was kind of thinking, it's like we're just like a big old spider web. The more of us get in there, the stronger we are because, we branch out from each other. And, and I have ladies that I am sponsoring here with me tonight. And I'm sure some of them have, sponsees that they're working with. And so it's just like in church when they used to say, get up and witness what God's done for you. We're telling each other what God has done for us and how to not drink one day at a time. And I was told early on that if I didn't give back what I was given, I would lose it. And I'm telling you, this is a precious gift. I do not want to lose this thing that's been given to me. And I think sometimes, like early on, if you had asked me to make a list of all the things I wanted out of sobriety, I guarantee you I would have shortchanged myself big time. You know, because for one thing, I didn't even know what I wanted. You know, when your mind's all fogged up with alcohol and you haven't even had time to clear your eyes good or your brain good or anything, it's hard to know what you want. And, as my sobriety years have added up and so on, those things have changed. Just like my relationship with God has changed. It's not what it was when I first came in here. I really had a real fear when I first came here that this thing wasn't going to work. Because when I looked up on the wall in that treatment center and saw that third step, turn your life and will over to the care of God as you understood Him, I thought, I've prayed. You don't know how many times I've prayed when I would go to bed at night that I wouldn't want to drink when I woke up the next day. And the first thought in my mind would be, how long do I have to go before I get a drink? I have to go to work. I don't get off work until now. And I know I can't drink at work. So, but just these constant obsessive thoughts of, you know, I don't have to be like that anymore. And I feel like now, like my mind, my mind's doing little tricks with me. I think part of that's age and whatever. Part of that's I just looked at the clock while ago. I was like, okay, 5 minutes. We better sum this thing up here right quick. But, and the gifts that the program has given me, again, is service work. When I talked about that simple little thing in the beginning of opening up a meeting, you know, today I chair meetings, and I honestly, when I say this, when I first came to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I introduced myself, if you've ever been around a child that is just absolutely petrified and their voice quivers, that's the child that walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could barely say my name without my voice quivering. I was so full of fear and had no hope or anything else. Today I have hope. I can, look at me, I've stood up here and ran my mouth for almost an hour, and I could barely say my name and that, I'm Rosetta, I'm an alcoholic. So believe me, there is lots of growth in this program, and that the thing that I ask, girls that I sponsor to do and friends in the program is, just don't quit until that miracle happens. Sometimes it takes longer for some of us than others. But one thing for sure, a drink has never made anything better. So, if I can just remember that, and it's a little bit easier today to remember, what to do, because I've practiced for almost 26 years, something you would have never convinced me that I'd been able to do when I walked in here, 1988. That's just amazing to me. It's truly amazing. So I'm just going to, I will tell you that not too long ago, and I just loved this because it talks about how the program works in other ways. A couple of you might have heard it, I don't know, but we were at a meeting and we were talking about how, how the program works in your life on a daily basis. And this guy was sharing, and of course none of us knew what he was talking about, but he was talking about he was having a really rough day, and he was sitting in the parking lot at Lowe's. And he said, he looked across the parking lot, and he said, here this angel pulled in, and she had HP for me on her license plate. And that was my tag. And, you know, and he said he was having a horrible day. And I knew it because when he saw me get out of the car, he jumped out of his truck and he ran over. And he said, "You don't know how bad I needed to see you today." And his son was in a golf tournament or something. And his wife had told him, she said, "I don't think he wants you to be there." And he was just really, he was in a lot of pain, a lot of emotional pain. But because he saw another member of Alcoholics Anonymous that he knew he could run up and get a hug from, he didn't drink that day. And he called me an angel. And that's just about the nicest thing I've ever been called other than Mom. So, you know, yeah, those other names prior to getting here. not nice stuff to do. So, when I was reading this morning, and it is from our literature, it's from the Daily Reflections, and we actually, you know, the Massanutta Springs meeting is, we take our topic from the Daily Reflections each week, but this just so fit me that I decided ahead of time that I was going to share at least these two parts of it. And it says, to be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantity some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. And that's from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 33. And then the other thing is it gets down into the meditation. And it says that, and anything I share is never original. I just wish I could come up with something one time I hadn't heard somebody else say, but it just doesn't happen. It's always what somebody else has passed on. And what it says is that I'd like to think that if sobriety is God's gift to me, then my sober life is my gift to God. And I hope God is as happy with his gift as I am with mine. Thank you.